pick session number 16395, reel 3.
General Crookenden, reel 3.
Mention of division reminds me that I might mention the people in my glider coming over. The Brigadier's batman, Private Kinch, was driving his jeep and towing our command net trailer with its 22 set. Kinch was a splendid man. He had been the Brigadier's chauffeur in peacetime. He joined the Scots Guards when the Brigadier was recalled from the reserve of officers, and after the war he became his farm manager. Also with us in the glider was John Darlington, the Deputy Assistant Adjutant General and Personnel Staff Officer at Divisional Headquarters, our command net set, and the three Royal Signals radio operators. Now, next morning, almost as soon as it was light, the Germans started the normal custom of heavily shelling and mortaring the whole area of our brigade headquarters orchard, La Barre de Ronville, and the positions held by the 12th Battalion and the Devonshire Regiment, who were holding the southern end of La Barre de Ronville in a reverse slope position, and about 200 yards forward of our brigade headquarters orchard. The men all took cover in their slit trenches, and most of us soon learnt the trick of telling from the noise of the approaching shell, the smaller shells, rather like a bus coming towards you, and the larger ones like a tube train coming towards you. And in fact, some of us were able to bluff the rest of the brigade headquarters that we were braver than we were, because you very soon learnt to appreciate how far off the shell was, to stand around looking nonchalant and fearfully cool, and at the last minute stepping into a slit trench and cowering down on the floor. The only snag was you can't do this with mortar bombs, because you can't hear them arriving, and they land with a swoosh and an immediate explosion. The brigade headquarters cooks, signalers, and orderlies were all really good and remained calm, not forgetting this was their first time under fire. The radio sets worked well, and we seemed to be entering our first major campaign fairly smoothly. About 1,000 yards to the south of La Barre de Ronville and the line we were holding as a division, over the open fields was the village of Saint-Honorine-la-Chardonnerette. And this was supposed to be the final objective of our brigade and the Royal Ulster Rifles. They went first, as ordered, as planned beforehand, to the village of Longueval down on the River Orne. And next morning, the 7th, they were due to attack St. Honorine. The attack was due to go off at 10. And just ahead of the Devons, and ahead of us, brigade headquarters, between us and St. Honorine, was a low mound, which we call Ring Contour 30. And from there you could see the open ground towards St. Honorine, which was a slope down and a slope up to the village St. Honorine on its low slope, slight slope. 10 o'clock I went forward to this ridge together with a machine gun platoon and one company of the Ulsters, who are going to give, from this little rise, fire support for the rest of the battalion as it attacked St. Honorine. Sure enough, at 10 o'clock, the machine guns opened fire, and the 3rd Division Artillery, who of course had landed at 7 o'clock that morning, at the appointed time, I think it was 10 o'clock in the morning, I was forward on this high ground. The C Company, the fire company of the Ulster Rifles was there, and their machine gun platoon. But at the appointed time, nothing happened. The 3rd Division Artillery fired, our machine guns fired, but nothing happened. No Ulster Rifles appeared attacking the village of St. Honorine. And shortly afterwards, a radio message was received saying the commanding officer had postponed HR, the hour of the attack, until 12 o'clock because the attacking companies had not yet reached the start line. Now, as Brigade Major, I got busy on the radio to discover the 3rd Division Artillery were not available at 12. They were busily engaged in supporting 3rd Division's battle already raging on the approach to Caen, on the other side of the Orne. The machine gun and mortar platoons with us were running short of ammunition. So we were in a serious problem. This was passed back to the CO of the Rifles, the Ulster Rifles, and the CO decided to proceed with the attack. At 12 o'clock, our machine guns opened fire again, the Ulster's mortars opened fire, and then we saw the leading companies of the Ulsters coming out of the village of Longueval and the woods surrounding it and moving across the open ground into the village of St. Honorine. There followed quite clearly the sound of grenades, small arms fire, Sten guns, German Schmeissers, rifles, and so on. And after about 20 minutes, to our great grief, I can feel it now, we saw the little figures of the Ulsters, 1,000 yards away, moving back from St. Honorine, back into Longueval, and we could hear the German firing at them as they withdrew. The attack had failed. The next happened on the left flank of our brigade. Over on the left, the Oxfordshire and Buckshamite Light Infantry had had a similar task to capture the village of Eskerville, which would be the left pivot or the left strong point of our brigade position. So Ronarine planned for the right point and Eskerville the left, all powerfully stone-built Norman villages dominating the open ground to the south over which we expected the attack of the 21st Panzer Division. Much the same thing happened there. The leading companies of the Ochsenbachs got into Eskerville. The Germans counterattacked vigorously with Panzer Grenadiers and Mark IV tanks, and they withdrew into the next village back to the north, Heruvelette, where they dissembled after their landing. So the brigadier decided we'd stay where we were, 52nd in Eskerville and the Ulster Rifles in Longueval, but we had failed to capture the two strong villages which we'd planned to make into the bases of our position. Another incident, typical of our brigadier, was that next day, or it might have been the day after, the Ulster Rifles came up on the radio and said, we are being worried by two Mark IV tanks who've come up to fairly close range and are shelling our positions. Our six-pounder anti-tank guns can't reach them. Help us. Now, the brigadier had commanded, before he joined us, a tank battalion of the Scots Guards, Churchill tanks. So he understood and knew about armored vehicles. And that day, coming from the beaches, two M10 tank destroyers manned by the Royal Artillery, a powerful anti-tank weapon and self-propelled on its tracks, had joined us. So the brigadier climbed into one of these M10 tank destroyers tell me to pick up two jeeploads of infantry from the brigade, he called it defence platoon, and motored off round by the Orne Valley to help the Ulsters by beating up these two Mark IV tanks. And I was to be infantry protection for this venture. And we motored off. It was late afternoon by this time. And the brigadier came up out of the river valley onto the ridge. We could see clearly the two Mark IV tanks about 800 yards away. The brigadier fired two rounds from his M10 tank destroyer. The Mark IV German tanks fired a couple of rounds back, both missed completely, and the German tanks rumbled away into the gathering evening light. We motored on into the Ulster Rifles, exacted payment for their relief by whiskey, and then returned to brigade headquarters. This was typical of our brigade commander's active participation in the battle. If anything was ever happening anywhere in our defensive role, he would always be there. His routine at brigade headquarters was that either he himself would be round battalions, visiting their forward companies, talking to their commanding officers, planning the patrol program for the next night, or I would be. So that either the brigadier or brigade major would always be either out and the other one in case anything happened which needed patrol from brigade headquarters. Then on the June the 12th, we were told that a famous division who served with great distinction in the desert and in Sicily was coming to attack through us and relieve us. We'd now been 6 days fairly continuously in action. We hadn't had much sleep, and we were very happy to hear that these veteran and splendid troops would attack through us and would move through the Devons and attack head-on due south over the open ground into this famous village of St. Honorine, where the Ulsters had been ejected 2 days before. We occupied the high ground immediately in front of the Devons to give them fire support. And I was sent down by my brigadier to see this newly arrived brigade who were going to do this attack and tell him our dispositions, our mortar positions, where we could help them with fire, our machine gun positions, everything we could to help with this attack. I saw the brigadier himself, and he rather rudely, offhand fashion, said, "Look here, Crookenden, we've done this before, you know. Don't bother." I was astounded by this extraordinary refusal of all the firepower we could bring to help him, saluted rather sulkily, and left. Next morning, the leading battalion of his new brigade advanced through the Devons. Their own divisional artillery once more pulverized the village of St. Honorine. Once again, the village disappeared in a cloud of shell burst smoke and dust. I went forward to this little high ground in front of us to watch the attack again. And then the leading battalion started their advance. And to my astonishment, they advanced in open order, as if on Salisbury Plain, the rifles at the high port, with two or three tanks moving amongst them. Exactly like a film of the Somme battle. No question of fire movement or anything of that sort. They got into the village of St. Honorine. They fired the success signal, red over green over red. And the second battalion, the follow-up battalion, were going to attack through St. Honorine onto the next village, 1,000 yards beyond, started advancing. Now, the good old German, as is invariable custom, a battle group of the 21st Panzer Division, had pulled all their men out of the village as the attacking battalion got close to them. And as soon as our people, the attacking battalion, were settled into St. Honorine, and obviously lighting up cigarettes and thinking they'd made it, back came the immediate German counterattack we grew to know so well. Two companies of Panzer Grenadiers and two or three self-propelled guns and tanks coming with them and hurled our people out of the village. Perfectly timed counterattack. Watching through my binoculars, I could see that leading battalion of ours coming back over the open ground, and halfway to the village, they got mixed up with the second battalion advancing through them. And to my complete horror and amazement, both battalions started coming back, and they streamed past me, streamed through the Devons positions, streamed past brigade headquarters in our orchard, shouting, yelling, some of them casting away their rifles, and many of them, officers included, shouting back to the beaches. The Devons did extremely well. They never moved from their slit trenches. Some of their sergeants were out between the slit trenches, knocking these fellows down with their rifle butts. And I was astounded in several ways, partly because some of them were coming through our brigade headquarters orchard, and other officers and myself were busy calming our people, telling them to stay where they were. But the most amazing sensation, personally, was that I felt strongly inclined to go with them. I thought to myself, these are veteran troops with a fine record. If they're running, well, I think I might go with them. And happily, I overcame that feeling, helped by all my mates all around us, and we all stayed where we were. But for a regular officer, trained at Sandhurst, coached in military history, father and grandfather soldiers, it was simply astounding to see this happen to the British Army. Now, what I can add, their own officers were horrified. They rallied behind our positions. They pulled themselves together. The CO of both battalions were sacked. The brigadier was sacked. And later on, the general of that division was sacked. They did pull themselves together. They were retrained. And by the time we came to 1945 and the crossing of the River Rhine, they were back again as a fighting division. But it was an eye-opener to see how well the Devons had behaved and how badly this lot had performed. Now we were relieved by that same division. They took over our positions facing south, and we were moved up to the eastern flank of our 6th Airborne Division Bridgehead, facing east, where German divisions had arrived from Le Havre, in particular the 386th Infantry Division, with whom we were involved for the next 4 or 5 weeks. Now let's pause for a minute. We now moved up to the eastern flank. The 9th Parachute Battalion, whose job had been the capture of the Merville Battery, and the whole of 3rd Parachute Brigade, had been involved in very heavy fighting with fresh German troops coming from Le Havre, the 386th Grenadier Division, as they called their infantry divisions, and they were now down to very few men in each battalion, 100, 200 men in each battalion. And the 9th Parachute Battalion had ended up in a big stud farm called the Chateau Saint-Côme. They are now about 150 men strong, I suppose. And one of our tasks was to relieve them facing east with the oxen bucks, and take over from the Canadian Parachute Battalion, part of the division, Parachute Battalion, on the big crossroads alongside it, called the Menil Crossroads. And I went up to see, as always, to see the battalions into position to coordinate the movement. And in the Shatters and Combe, they had these beautiful paddocks full of mares and foals, a lot of them owners from England, including Lord Derby. And as I walked through the companies of the oxen bucks, the company nearest the enemy, out on a slight limb, was the chateau itself, already the scene of previous heavy fighting in the previous week. And as I walked up to the chateau, along the chateau drive, I passed one of the companies, the oxen bucks, dug in along the drive, and my aim was to go into the chateau where another platoon of the oxen bucks were holding it. And as I approached the chateau, past the little wood, the Germans, who were in the stables, which I hadn't realized, quite close to the chateau, fired a small mortar bomb, which landed the other side of a big tree from me, went off, did me no harm, except blew off the heel of my right boot. I limped on into the chateau, chatted up the platoon commander and his platoon holding it, and as I limped back down the drive, I cursed the soldiers of the platoons holding the drive and said, "Why the hell didn't you tell me there were Germans in the chateau?" And they all laughed and said, "Well, sir, officer, you would know already." And roared with laughter at seeing a staff officer with the right heel of his boot blown off. Even more embarrassing later, I reached the battalion headquarters of the Oxen Bucks, and after I talked to the CO and my various friends there, I said, "I wonder if someone could lend me a gym shoe, and could your MO put a strap or a plaster on my heel, which was bleeding?" And they did that and lent me a gym shoe. And then the MO said, "Turn round. Just a minute, you've got a hole in your back." A very small one was. "And I'm ashamed to tell you, I fainted dead away." I made the ribald merriment of my friends in the oxen bucks. This was a very tiny hole, and I still have a piece of mortar bomb in the back of my ribs. The oxen bucks held their position extremely well. They had developed, to a high degree, their snipers. Now, the country on the ridge there, we were now holding, totally different from down in the bottom in the river plain, was thick bocage, beautiful paddocks, separated by a steep bank, and the bank, on top of the bank, a thick hedge, very difficult for tanks, and very close quarters for infantry. And the Germans were now about a field away, a paddock or two away, very close, and the oxen bucks developed very well their snipers and scored quite a number of Germans because they seemed extraordinarily thick. On their next paddock, on one of these banks and hedges, there was a gap in the hedge, and a German soldier had gone by two or three times, and eventually one of the oxen buck snipers had knocked him off. Two more Germans in the next 2 days went by the same gap, and both of them fell victim to these snipers of the oxen bucks. Very good example of how valuable snipers can be. Well, now, next village to this stud farm, although in the middle of our defensive line, was still held by the Germans. And from it, they'd been a definite nuisance to our defenses with patrols, counterattacks, and so on. It was now the 12th of June. It was getting on in the afternoon. All General Gale's troops, all our troops in the 6th Airborne had had 6 days' heavy fighting. They were all down to about half strength, and they were very tired. His only reserves, back by the riverbank, down in the bottom there, was the 12th Battalion, the Parachute Regiment, down to 300 men, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Johnny Johnson, and a reserve company of the Devons, commanded by John Bamfield, D Company, about 80 men. General Gale, on that 12th of June, had been offered the loan of a squadron of Sherman tanks of the 13th 18th Royal Hussars, and the guns of the 51st Highland Division firing from across the Orne at a fairly extreme range. Both the guns of the 51st and the tanks were required by their own divisions for an attack at midnight that day, the 12th. And General Gray could only have them up to 11 p.m. He decided, as he said in his memoirs, that the running sore of Breville must be liquidated, and he therefore gave orders that the 12th Battalion, his reserve, with a company of the Devons under command, would attack this last village in German hands, Breville, at 10 o'clock. The 51st Division Artillery would open fire at 10 to 10, and the tanks would move up to support the attack at 10 p.m. The attack was to go in against Breville from the north, from the village of Omfraville, now held by the commander brigade, who had landed on D-Day by sea and had extended our divisional line to the north towards the sea. The south end of Omfraville was held by No. 6 Commando, and the start line for the attack by the 12th Battalion and the 12th Devons was on the southern edge of Montpellier, with about 500 yards of open fields between the start line and the village of Breville. Time was short if they were to reach the start line in time for the opening of the artillery preparation. And Johnny Johnson did rather gently complained to me he'd be pushed to make it in time. And the Devons under Benfield, D Company, who would have the same problem. My Brigadier Kindersley, was worried about the shortage of time too. And he decided to go up to the start line itself and to watch how the attack went and to see that all was well. I stayed brigade headquarters down by the river to run the brigade headquarters command set and so on. By 20 minutes to 10, the 12th Parachute Battalion, 300 of them, were hurrying through Omfraville to reach that start line on the southern end of the village in time. The Devons were even further behind. They'd had further to go. And they were coming up through the Omfraville village square at about 9:45. At 9:50, the artillery, three regiments of field guns and one of medium, over 100 guns, are on time at 10:50. A lot of